Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Want to talk with Zorba? Call 1-800-462-7413. Along with interesting callers, some interesting research.
So. Yes, we're going to look at alcohol, tobacco, illegal drugs, which is worse, what do they say in the UK? How are they looking at how to look at these various drugs, legal and illegal, and put them into a perspective?
And?
Angioplasties. Are they needed? Are they overused? It'll study that is a landmark study. Some say it's controversial. I think the study is dynamite and is very, very sound science.
It was big news not that long ago,
news,
and we'll talk about it here.
Stuff.
And we have, believe this or not, a recipe from a guest chef, Lydia Critchley.
Oh, it's a wonderful recipe. Honey carrot snacking cake. I love the idea of snacking.
And for those of you who are diabetic, this is a recipe for diabetics.
Absolutely.
So you want to listen along
recipe.
For that. Again, our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's get to the phones. A listener with us now in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Okay, I have a marathon to run in 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and it's the first one I've ever run, and I'm a little concerned because my right knee has been preventing me from going more than 6 miles before it starts hurting, and I haven't been able to do the long runs that I'm supposed to be
doing. Is this a 26-miler you
want to run? Correct.
Ah. Well, Zorba will have his advice. Mine is don't do it. Just...
Awful.
Sit and watch television.
Don't do the running. I love it. Don't do the running.
What do you say, Zora?
Well, first of all, you know, you've had this for how long? When did this actually start? Was there an event that did it?
Yes.
Was it after? Tell me a bit about
okay.
it.
Okay. I ran 18 miles, and it started there, and I couldn't run the whole way. I had to walk, but I could limp my way through it. And then after, that was about 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, after that, I have not been able to go more than 7. And it almost
uh-huh.
feels
uh-huh.
like it locks up.
Oh, it locks up. Okay.
And I try
very
to,
important.
You know,
uh-huh.
do knee bends and stuff, but I can never get back to actually starting to run
yeah,
again.
Yeah, it locks up. Well, I don't have good news for you because what you describe sounds to me like a meniscus or a cartilage injury. That's what it sounds like, especially a knee that locks up. Usually a knee that locks up means there's a piece of cartilage. The meniscus is the covering, if you will, on top within the knee between the bone in the upper leg, the femur and the tibia and the fibula. And the meniscus, this sort of plastic-looking covering, can often tear, and the body cannot repair it. And that's why arthroscopic surgery basically repairs these things. But this sounds like a meniscus injury that occurred, and you're going to need some help for this. You know, the other issue is maybe you should settle for a half marathon this year versus
I know.
A full marathon.
I would
highly recommend it. You know, you don't want to be limping at the end of, you know, the whole thing, and all of a sudden it puts a whole bummer on it. And a different perspective with a half marathon. I'm going to do this much, and you might succeed in doing that with a bit of
help. But now, mentally, would you feel really bad starting it and then not being able to finish?
Yeah. Just because I've already done 3 halves. So I really wanted to do a whole one.
Yeah, but I don't think this is the year to do it. I mean, I got to tell you, you most likely have a cartilage injury. And with a cartilage injury, the longer you run on it, the more sort of the inflammation is around, the more fluid in the knee, the more symptoms you have. And if you find this at 7 miles, chances are you're not going to complete it. And so you've got to think in your brain, would I rather complete a half marathon and succeed in that? And next year, and I'm going to get my knee taken care of with good orthopedic pod, and next year I'm going to do a full marathon, or I'm going to take my risk and I'm going to go for it, even though I might be in a lot of pain. And you got to think about what you want to do psychologically. I don't think you're going to injure yourself more.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And thank you very
it.
Much for calling.
Okay.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
800-462-7413. What was that number? 800-462-7413 to talk with Zorba. A listener now, Zorba, in West Bend, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Well, my problem is also exercise-related.
Mm-hmm.
I have been running 20 plus years, but I still get...
Without stopping?
Stop and stop. Sleep, Tom. She has to sleep.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I get extremely sore if I go, like, more than 2 days in between my next run. I'll get extremely sore. And then the other days, I do other exercises. And, you know, if I do more than I'm used to or, you know, something new, and it's been this way forever. You know, so I'm just concerned that as I get older and people tend to get more sore and stiff, that I'm going to have, you know, kind of a double whammy.
That's it. And what will happen is you'll just, you know, you'll get more achy and you'll hardly move your body. And then you'll become sort of, you know, disheveled as time goes on. And that's old age.
And that's the good
you'll
news.
You'll bend over right now.
Creep, and you'll live for 10 years in a nursing home and then you'll pass away. And, you know, other than that, I think I have good news for you. But, you know, it's interesting. This may not progress. This may just be you and the way your muscles are. And you have this thought, which is pretty logical. Well, as I get older, it's going to get worse and worse and worse because we tend to have more pain as we get older. We have more joint pain from arthritis. We don't tolerate pain as well. It's hard for us to get above pain when we're younger, but we have that vitality and enthusiasm, and frankly, we don't ache as much. I mean, I had backaches periodically when I was younger, but now that I'm older, I woke up this morning with a backache. I don't remember doing that in my 20s. You know, it was when I lifted something heavy. Is this with all exercise you do or just some exercise that you do?
Everything. I mean, golfing, even bowling. I'll go bowling and be sore the next day.
Is bowling sort of the lowest end exercise? We can have marathon running at one end and bowling at the other end. You know, bowling's got a bad name. I mean, you know, Buzz Fazio, he was a, you know, nobody means Buzz Fazio. I'm sorry. He was a big guy when I was a young kid.
Yeah.
But this is going on since you were a teenager. Like you said, it's gone on as far as you can remember back.
Well, I even remember high school track, like barely being able to get out of bed in the morning.
Uh-huh. So this has gone on for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, some people have achier muscles than other people. I know this is not much of an explanation, but if you remember this back to high school, it's never going to go away. The reality is high school is a time when you're really, you know, in early college, 18, 20, 21, when your body is really at its optimal physical condition. And if you're doing the stretches before and the stretches after and you've been told, this is basically your body. This is your body. And it may be the result of lactic acid that builds up in your body when you exercise, when you run, you build up lactic acid, and we know that lactic acid in the body causes these muscle aches.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your question is this going to get worse as I get older? And my answer is, I doubt it.
Okay.
I think this is your body the way that it is. Now, you may develop arthritis as you get older, but I think there won't be a progression of your muscle aches so that you can't move, and that's kind of the fear that you have there, and I don't think there's any evidence of that. I think when you exercise heavily, you just ache.
What about cutting back a little bit on the exercise?
Well, yeah.
I work out, but I'm not...
40
no.
minutes
I mean,
is not, you're, not running,
for,
you're not running for 2 hours. You
no.
know, you're not.
Less than an hour.
You know, I mean, 40 minutes, you know, for some people, of course, that's a lot of exercise. But for somebody who's done track in high school and other stuff, that's par for the course. And golfing, you know, golfing is, you know, in the bowling part of exercise if you use a cart. And if not, you're walking. No, I think these are your muscles. I don't think you'll progress. That's the issue. So my recommendation is maybe almost meditation and visualization at the end of it, and realize this is your body now responding to exercise, and think of that as a positive part of your body. Your body is now responding to the exercise, and it's sort of a regrouping, and look at that pain as muscle mass buildup, and that may help you deal with the pain. That's what I would do.
Okay.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks.
Thanks
for calling.
Appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. To research, Zorba, what some are calling landmark research on stuff that might be bad for us.
Well, first of all, it's published in the British Medical Journal of The Lancet, which is a dynamite journal. That's like the New England Journal of Medicine in the U.S. So it's an important article, and it's an article looking at where does alcohol and tobacco, where do they fit in, for instance, with marijuana and ecstasy? So you take two drugs that are
illegal.
Not heroin, not cocaine. We know heroin and cocaine are awful. I mean, we know that they're awful things. We're talking about softer drugs. Certainly marijuana would be a softer drug. And ecstasy, you could
certainly. Does ecstasy fall into that softer drug category?
It's not heroin and it's not cocaine, but certainly it would not. It would be somewhere in between, perhaps.
Yeah, okay,
you know, if you were to, if I were to put it on a scale, I would put it somewhere in between. I certainly would put cocaine. I certainly would put crack up there, and I certainly would put heroin up there. And they looked at different factors to sort of put these in with alcohol and tobacco. You know, they're legal drugs.
As far as harm to the body.
Harm to the body. Well, they actually looked at a few things. They looked at potential for addiction. They looked at the impact on society, and they looked at physical harm for the body.
Okay.
So how does it harm you? How does it affect society? Remember, we don't have these really bad ones out there, and we look at addiction.
Affecting society, meaning people likely to go out and rob other people.
Yeah,
and
rob other people, get into car crashes, hit somebody, murder somebody. There are a lot of effects to society of drugs. You know, and what they did is they looked at police officials and they looked at psychiatrists. Okay, so they looked from a medical model point of view, police model point of view, detectives, and said, and they asked them to assign a score of 1 to 20 to different drugs, and then they put the other drugs in a side part of this. They put in heroin, cocaine, amphetamines, and LSD, and they put that off to the side. And what they calculated in the end was that heroin and cocaine were ranked as the most dangerous. No shock there at all.
Right.
Barbiturates and street methadone were also up there. Methadone is really, you know, it's like heroin. It can cause a lot of addiction to people, barbiturates. But after that came alcohol. And if you look at marijuana, it was down there to number 11. And you look at ecstasy, it was even farther. So alcohol, after heroin and methadone or crack,
tobacco
was way up. Then it was right next to alcohol. It was number 6 or 7. So when you look at impact of society, you have to say, well, where do we put a perspective on these drugs? And then where do we put our money? If we look at the money that we spend on marijuana and marijuana eradication in this society versus taking that money, for instance, and putting it into alcohol rehabilitation, teaching children in school that binge drinking is as bad as drinking every day, and in fact that they may be alcoholics if they binge drink on the weekend, that it may be that it's just as bad. If we do that, maybe what we're going to do is have a better impact on society. And, you know, you look at the ads on television. I mean, I watch The Daily Show every night with Jon Stewart, and I look at the ads, and half the ads are alcohol-related ads. You know, drink Bacardi rum and have a great time, you know. And yet I don't see any ads talking about binge drinking, obviously. So that's what they're looking at. Where do we spend our money to make our society better? And it turns out that we'll get a lot of bang for our buck with alcohol versus marijuana and ecstasy eradication, for which there's no evidence we've gotten any bang for our buck.
Yeah. The people who advocate legal marijuana always say that the reason that it won't happen is because businesses won't be able to make a lot of money on it like they can with cigarettes and with
alcohol. You know, and that's a society argument. I don't have an opinion on that. I don't know one way or the other, but I do have an opinion on the fact that we don't spend a lot of time telling our children we don't spend the money telling them not to smoke cigarettes and to teach them that you can drink, quote, in a responsible way. I think you can, but you can become an alcoholic. And how do you keep from that from happening? When you look at 10% of the population of 15% are alcoholics and problem drinkers, and we might be able to stem this tide in high school and in early college with some education. Why don't we rechange those those priorities? That's what the article talked about.
Gotcha. 800-462-7413. And a listener now in St. Mary's, Idaho. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Here is my issue. A few months ago, I went to the chiropractor just for some back pain stuff, and I was telling him about this TMJ that I have, and he did a few things, pushed on my temples and somehow managed to crack my cheek, and then he at the very end, he pulled on my earlobe and popped it, and it was like a knuckle. And so I thought it was kind of odd, but it did feel better, and my teeth felt like they were not grinding as much. So I started doing that on my own more as almost a nervous habit, and I don't know how I got around to it, but I started pulling on the tops of my ears. Really had to crank on them, but I did get them to pop.
Wait a minute. I'm trying to visualize. You pull on the pull on the top of your ear and something pops?
Yeah.
The jaw pops?
No, my ear pops.
Your ear.
But not like when you blow your nose and pop your ear. It's more like if you're cracking your knuckles.
Like
kind of
the eardrum popping, sort of.
No. Like cartilage or something.
Oh, okay. And is that fun for you to do that, or?
Well, it does relieve a little stress and tension. What I usually notice with the DMJ is that, like, my temples and the side of my head get more sore from grinding my teeth and that kind of thing.
So let me get this straight. So the chiropractor did this as part of the manipulation?
The chiropractor did it, and his kind of thing was, it was actually after the session was over, he's like, oh, I forgot to do this. And he pulls on my earlobe, and he says...
You mean, wait a minute. As you're walking out the door, the chiropractor says, wait, I forgot to do this, pulls out in your ear, and your ear pops, and you feel good? You mean this is like a goodbye from the chiropractor?
It's a small town. No, it was kind of a... he popped it, and it was like he said it was some kind of measure of whether how much I'd been grinding or how much my jaw was, you know, and... But it actually did feel kind of like it kind of relieved some pressure. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
When I first did the top of my ear, mm-hmm. though, it was not as easy, and I don't know why I worked on it.
I don't know. It felt really tense,
and I intuitively thought, if I really pull on this, and it hurt the first time I did it, but I don't know why.
But now it relieves. So when you've got tension now, it relieves tension in your body
mm-hmm.
when you feel tense?
It relieves tension around my jaw and where the jaw meets the skull.
You know what? It's a non-drug way to deal with tension that's in your head. I don't think you're doing yourself any harm, but I must tell you this is one of the stranger calls I have received in my career as a radio person. Good luck, and
I'm not ripping my ear off, though, am I?
I am sure there are ear poppers out there who are going to just flood our email box.
I don't think there are.
Oh, yeah, right. Give me a break.
This caller is unique.
No. It's like the green beans that, you know, sparked in the microwave. We've got lots of people out there popping their ears, I'm sure.
Thank you very much for the call at 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help out Don now in Lewistown, Montana. It seems as though Don's lifelong doctor has retired and he needs some advice on finding a new one. Don's an aging guy with no severe medical issues, but hasn't ever had to select a new doc. Any tips?
Well, the best tip, because it's hard to find a physician that you can relate to or like, is to talk to somebody who you know and like. You know, so you're in a new town, you come there, maybe you've got a job, maybe you've made some friends, and you say, where do you go? It might be a clinic, it might be a medical center, it might be an individual doctor's office. That's sort of the way to do it. Step two. A lot of doctors, but not all, will have a get acquainted visit. In a get acquainted visit, you don't ask any questions about your medical health. You come in there, and often there is no charge, and you have to ask, and you meet the doctor, and you talk for 3 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes. And if they have one, that may be another way. Third way, new physicians often have more time. And they're very well trained, you know, like anyone else. They often will have very good judgment. They're new. They have more time. And if you've got a doctor in an area that's starting up a practice, mm-hmm. that's kind of a good place to go to because they often will give you more time of day. Physicians who have been there for 10 or 20 or 30 years might have a busy practice. And often, people, we like time. We like to have more time. The average doctor spends 12 to 14 minutes at a patient visit with there and actually spends about 6 or 7 minutes doing the paperwork. So new doctor. That's another way. Those are kind of tips that I think of. Do not call the medical society. They give you the next person on the list. Do not call your local hospital. They give you the next person on the list. And do not look at the ads in the Yellow Pages because there are ads in the Yellow Pages.
Good advice. And if you have a question for Zorba or just want to give us your comment, send us an email. Just send it to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around. More of your calls coming up at 800-462-7413. Next, though, we will be on the phone with Lydia Critchley, who is a chef in Madison, Wisconsin. And we have a great recipe from her for you, especially for you if you happen to be diabetic. On Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Thinking back, wasn't that last guy just pulling our ears?
Oh, gosh, Tom.
Don't you think he was just pulling our ears? Was that a real call or was that?
It's a real call. People do things. People do strange things.
I think he was pulling our
ears. People do strange things.
Recipe time. And this, a first for Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We welcome, during this next few minutes, a guest chef from Madison, Wisconsin, with a recipe that especially those of you who are diabetic will be interested in, but I think the rest of us will be interested in too. Let me welcome Lydia Critchley. Lydia, hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm just wonderful, thank you.
We really appreciate your joining us here. And you confess that you have had...
Confess?
Well, let me say...
confess, that's a big word, Tom, confess.
A life... You're like Zorba in this respect. You've had a lifelong desire to play with food.
You've got it.
You too, Zorba.
Absolutely. I love food.
Oh,
I love food.
This is a real mesh.
Yeah, I love food, so this is great. Tell me, how long have you been making this honey carrot snacking cake?
I've been making it for quite a while. It's it's healthy, it's tasty. You can use it for breakfast. It's just handy for everything, even if you want to pass it as a dessert and things like this. It's so all around.
Obviously, you like it, and other people must like it, too.
For those of us who aren't diabetics will know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. For those of us who aren't, what is it about this recipe that makes it okay for diabetics?
Well, you've got natural honey in it. You don't have a lot of extra other ingredients other than the natural sugars that are in your orange juice and raisins and things like this.
Aha. So being sugar-free is the main aspect.
Well, no, but it's not sugar-free, Tom, because it uses honey, so it's not sugar-free. This is not a sugar-free recipe. This is a recipe that has reduced sugar in it.
Okay, so anything that has honey in it is
But if we look at people with diabetes and the issue that they have, they always have an issue metabolizing carbohydrates. So anytime you have a carbohydrate, it's an issue, and diabetics have to look at it, and they still have to limit what they have. So this is not strictly a cake for diabetics at all because it's not sugar-free. But if it has reduced sugar, if it's a bit healthier, that's what it looks for. And more importantly, you know, the average, when people have an average slice of a cake, it's about 400 or 500 calories. This is 275 calories. Reduce the carbohydrate load. It's better for your body.
Gotcha. Well, we're going to go through this, and Lydia, feel free to join in here whenever you want, okay?
So we start out with a quarter of a cup of butter.
Quarter cup of butter.
Okay, now, we've got to look at butter. Well, we've got to look at butter and margarine. We have to put it into a perspective. What's the big kid on the block? The elephant that, you know, the elephant in the room were trans fats. Trans fats came from margarine when margarine was hardened. For the last 30 years, we've been saying, use margarine, don't use butter. Butter has trans fats in it. They're natural trans fats. And one of the issues in front of dietitians and people who are interested in nutrition is whether natural trans fats, the natural trans fats and saturated fats in butter, are the same as the trans fats that were traditionally put into foods to give them a long shelf life. Yeah. I'm now of the belief that a moderate amount of butter for most people is okay, and a lot of butter is not okay.
And this is a quarter cup in the whole cake, so it's
in the whole cake,
a bunch
the cake
of pieces.
Yeah. Six people, so I think it's in there.
Okay.
A half cup of honey.
Half a cup of honey.
Where do you get your honey?
I'm not particular where I buy my honey, but a lot of things, something that people aren't aware of is honey. Most people know that if you put it in warm water, if it candies, it'll soften up again and you'll get rid of the candied aspect. A lot of people ask, why do some honeys candy and others don't candy?
And when she says candy, you mean why do they firm up?
And it just depends on the honey. It depends on things like this. It's not always a given thing that it's something that you as an individual have done right or wrong with your honey.
But warming it up is really a great point because when I have honey in the house, I'll look at it and it'll be firm and I always put it in the microwave. That's what I do.
Okay.
One egg.
One egg. Do you want to ask her where she gets
her
eggs?
No, I'm not going to talk about that. Please.
I would recommend a large size egg on that.
Okay. One large egg. One cup of finely grated carrots.
A cup of finely grated carrots.
A quarter cup of golden raisins.
Sometimes called sultanas also.
Oh.
S-U-L-T-A-N-A-S.
Oh, really?
Sultana raisins.
So
okay.
If they go shopping and they can't find one, don't be afraid to grab the other one. Okay.
Two tablespoonfuls of orange juice.
Two big tea OJ.
A teaspoon of vanilla.
Little tea vanilla.
Half cup of all-purpose flour.
Half a cup of flour.
And a half cup of whole wheat flour.
a half a cup of whole wheat flour.
That's right. So, once again, taking a recipe, making it healthier, using some whole wheat flour immediately begins to make it healthier. I mean, when we're done, but it's a healthier dessert.
Is there some reason, Lydia, you can't use the whole cup of whole wheat flour?
Yes, it is, because there's a difference in your gluten level. And this is why you want to balance it between the two, and you'll have a much better product. Getting to the whole wheat flour, I recommend people for storage with the whole wheat flour to always store it. I store mine in the freezer. Mm-hmm. Some people, if they use it quite frequently, may want to put it in the refrigerator. Remember, it's chilled, so it's nice if you bring it back to room temperature before you use it because it won't chill your batter down. But at the same time, because your whole wheat flour hasn't been bleached and all these things, it'll keep far longer without problems if you refrigerate or freeze it.
That's a good point. And freezer, at least in my house, because it's in the basement, it's easier to kind of put it in there and just put it off to the side.
Okay.
A teaspoon of baking powder.
A little tea baking powder.
3/4 teaspoon of ground cinnamon.
3/4 little tea ground cinnamon.
1/2 teaspoon of baking soda.
1/2 little tea baking soda.
1/4 teaspoon of salt.
1/4 little tea salt.
1/4 teaspoon of ground ginger.
1/4 little tea ground ginger.
1/8 teaspoon of ground nutmeg.
1/8 of a little tea ground nutmeg.
Now, Lydia, I've got a question for you. When you use nutmeg, do you take the nutmeg and take it out of a container that's been pre-ground, or do you grind it fresh? Do you think it makes any difference in this recipe? You know, where you get the actual nutmegs and you grind it on a little grinder.
It's not going to make a whole lot of difference. I'll be honest, I use the pre-ground, and I like to get good quality. However, if you use it on a grinder, you may not get it as fine.
That's correct. A good point. And getting quality spices really does make a difference.
Yes, it does.
Okay, so we're going to preheat the oven at 350 degrees. So take the butter, cream it in a large bowl. That means make it so it's nice and soft and mushy and creamy-like, which you do with a spoon or some other device you want to use. Then gradually beat in the honey until it's light and fluffy. Add the egg, continuing to beat well. Then combine the carrots, raisins, orange juice, and vanilla in a separate bowl. Then combine in another bowl the dry ingredients. Those are all the dry ingredients that we had, which included the flours, baking powder, cinnamon, baking soda, salt, ginger, and nutmeg in another bowl. And then add the dry ingredients to the cream mixture, and then alternately add the carrot mixture. So you add the dry ingredients to the cream mixture, put in the carrot mixture, beating and ending with the dry ingredients so that everything is all mixed together nicely. Bake it in an 8-inch or a 9 by 11.5-inch pan, grease pan. Make sure you grease it or use something that has Teflon on it. You can also put it in cupcake pans. Bake it for 35 to 45 minutes, of course, until a wooden stick comes out, either one of those little baking picks that you have or a toothpick. And bon appetit. Yeah. It will serve, it's 275 calories. This will serve 6 people. Once again, it is a reduced caloric dessert. It's still a dessert, so it's not totally sugar free by any means and carbohydrate free, but it's a great recipe.
You could put nuts in there, Lydia?
Nuts are optional, yes.
What kind would you use?
I would use walnuts or pecans.
Yeah.
Sounds great. You can mix it in there. Sounds like a dynamite recipe. I can't wait to try it out. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. I'm sure this is going to be popular with our listeners.
Thanks, Lydia.
You're very welcome.
Lydia Critchley is the owner of Creative Cooking by Lydia and teaches food classes in the Madison, Wisconsin area. For more info and recipes, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org.
And for today's recipe, send a stamped self-addressed business-sized envelope to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip 53706.
Or come to our website at zorbapastor.org, where you can sign up for our weekly podcast.
We'll take another call now at 1-800-462-7413. A listener with a Zorba in Mavada, Missouri. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help you?
Well, first, thank you, Tom and Dr. Z. I really appreciate you taking my call, and I've been listening to you for years and respect your opinions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I have BHP. Was diagnosed with it about 10 years ago, and at that time...
I'm sorry, you have what?
BPH, enlarged prostate.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. So that brings me to my real question for you today. I've been considering doing the either the transurethral microwave therapy or a cold thermotherapy, which I think is another version of the microwave therapy. The later one, my wife's uncle, who's 78, just had that one done, and he's just elated about how well it works, and that he had it done in December. My problem is the urologist I see does the first one, the transurethral microwave therapy. So I don't know which one would be better to do or safer to do, especially since I've had a knee replacement.
Sure. First of all, Zorba, what's he talking about?
Well, let's look at what you have. You have an enlarged prostate.
Kind of now, hard to get that prostate in a microwave.
Well, yeah, put your prostate in the microwave. That'd be sort of an odd thought. But how often are you getting up and going to the washroom?
About every 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay, how about at night? How often are you getting up at night?
At least 3 to 5 times a night.
That's the issue. One of the issues of deciding, well, when am I going to get therapy for this? When am I going to have some sort of a surgical therapy, be it cold therapy, hot therapy, you know, prostate removal of a variety of different ways? You know, when do I start to do it? And it's usually when you can't sleep. I mean, during the day, if you go to the washroom once an hour, it may be bothersome. During the night, if you have to go to the washroom once an hour, it's very bothersome and can produce some significant problems. There's a new study that also shows that a drug called Proscar, a drug that may also shrink the prostate when combined with Flomax and other drugs of that class, together may add some extra benefit. But if you're going 3 to 5 times a night, you're probably going to need some sort of surgical procedure. First off, all procedures are the same. The methods are different. The procedure is to take that apple of a prostate that's around the end of the bladder and core it out so that it doesn't bother you. That's really what the procedure is. And there are different ways of doing it. You can do it with a knife. You can do it with a laser. You can do it with a microwave. And you can do it freezing. And frankly, the results can be absolutely all the same. Now, some will say, my results are better. They have fewer side effects. And the other group will say, they know my results are better. We have fewer side effects. But the fact is they both have the same side effects of you may have dribbling when it's finished. And you may have some increase of other problems. You may need to have second or third procedures. Now, question for you. Your urologist, do you like them?
Yes.
Think they have good, you know, you've gone to see them a couple of times. How long have you seen this person?
3 years now.
3 years. And you think the urologist has good, you know, I mean, you're happy with the judgment of that urologist?
Yeah, I like him a lot.
I think step number one is if you're happy with that person, that's the person you go to. And if you wonder if the other technique is better for you, you get a second opinion. Yeah. In other words, you go to the person that does the other technique, you sit with them, and quite often I think of it as the sniff test. You look at person A and person B, and you compare them together, and immediately, in many cases, you'll say, either one is fine, or I like this person.
Yeah.
So I would do that. Good luck.
And thank you very much for the call at 1-800-462-7413. To Buffalo, New York we go. Hello.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
We're fine. How can we help you?
Well, I had a couple questions. Recently, I went for a physical, which I go for every year, and during the exam, the doctor indicated that he believed my tonsils were a little larger than they should be for a male, as he put it. And I had some radiation treatment done on my chest for acne when I was 15 years old. I'm 56 now.
Mm-hmm.
And he was concerned about that relative to my throat being a little larger than normal and sent me to a specialist. Prior to that, I went to get an ultrasound. And there's a small polyp on one of my lobes, not large at all, not large enough to biopsy. And the specialist said, come back in 6 months. Prior to coming back, go for another blood test and also have another ultrasound. And I was just curious, what causes that whole thing to...
Well, you had an ultrasound of what?
Of my thyroid.
So you had an ultrasound of your thyroid. And
correct.
So when they looked at the ultrasound of the thyroid, they said, this part looks generous and we want to look at it again in 6 months.
Yes, they showed me the ultrasound. It had a little bit of a raised area on it.
Well, let me tell you that one of the issues, you know, you had when you were 15 years of age, you suffered from good medical care. And good medical care in those days was, let's do something called soft x-rays to the chest for acne. And that's what they did. They gave x-rays for a lot of things. They gave it to tonsils to shrink tonsils. They gave it to the chest for acne. They gave it to the face for acne. And, of course, the issue is whether or not that's causing cancer. I mean, that's the bottom line issue because we know x-rays cause cancer. Too many x-rays and you get too much cancer. So the question then is, do you have cancer of the thyroid or do you have cancer of the tonsils? I mean, and the answer is, you know, you're at a higher risk because you had this x-ray. It doesn't mean you have it, but you're at a higher risk. So let's look at the tonsils. You can have generous tonsils. It doesn't mean that you have cancer there. When you saw the ENT doc and they looked at the tonsils, did they think it needed to be biopsied?
Well, he said come back in 6 months. And if that polyp is a little larger, we'll biopsy it.
That's the answer. And the reason is you want to know whether or not that's a cancerous thing. So, I mean, to me, that's pretty logical. But this is about the time that these cancers may show up. And we're seeing cancers that show up in people who had these indiscriminate use of x-rays, which, as I said, was good medical care back in the 50s, you know, back in the 50s and the 60s. So I think going back and looking at it again. And the other issue is that, hey, okay, you went to doctor number one. Doctor number one said, I think this looks okay. Let's wait 6 months. But let's say you're anxious. You don't know, was this the right thing or the wrong thing? I say go to doctor number two and see if they say the same thing, because there are a lot of biopsies that are done indiscriminately. On the other hand, there are biopsies that are done discriminately for good reason. And I think if you have a question, a second opinion in a case like this can be very, very useful. A lot of these, if they're there, are slow-growing cancers, but there are other tests that you can do to, you know, to look at this. So, you know, you're at risk. It's important.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling us at 800-462-7413. Remember when they had x-ray machines in shoe stores?
Yes, I do. Of course. Of course. We're talking about. My mother never let me put my feet in there because she was afraid of them. She was afraid of a lot of things, but she was afraid of them. She said, I don't think they're safe.
Legitimately so.
Oh,
there.
She was right. They gave a dose of x-rays to your gonads. It wasn't good at all.
Well, Zorba, as you well know, I've told my poison ivy story over and over and over again on this program, boring the dickens out of everybody. Well, the last time I did it a while back, the story triggered Sharon from Meridian, Idaho, to send us her tips about poison ivy. She writes, when you take your clothes off, put them directly in the washer. Another person can contract the poison ivy from touching clothes with the oil on it. Poison ivy can also be contracted by touching a dog that has walked through it, or even from the smoke from a fire where it is burning.
Oh, absolutely. These are well-known things. Other things that I would recommend if you suffer from poison ivy and it's the season and it's around the house where you are, is keep a couple of sets of rubber gloves, you know, dishwashing gloves around the area where you're going to put the stuff in the washing machine. Because frankly, if you handle clothes with your hands that have the oil of poison ivy, you'll get it. And you take dishwashing gloves, you put that in, it doesn't touch your skin, and then you wash the gloves.
Yeah.
You know, you can put the gloves right in the washing machine also, and it'll get rid of that.
And if you get it, just don't try to treat it with toothpaste, as I did.
No, do not try to treat it with toothpaste. Absolutely, Tom.
Send us your thoughts in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some really interesting research coming up, and we have our medical myth buster for you, and maybe you have some more calls for us at 1-800-462-7413. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We'll do this research now, Zorba. Not an overstatement, I think, to say that when this one appeared recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, it shook the medical community.
Oh, absolutely. This is an important landmark study that gives stunning results, that is a good scientifically based study that shows that many angioplasties that are given throughout the country are worthless. They're not doing anything. And
maybe most angioplasties.
Oh, yeah, most angioplasties. And it's a surprising result, but hey, that's what science is. Science isn't a vote. It's take groups, look at it, let's see what we have. And, of course, this study will be looked at, and the naysayers will say, well, this was wrong, that was wrong, this was wrong, that was wrong. We didn't use this one. There's new stuff. The fact is, it's a really good study.
Talk about it.
two groups of people. Group number one. Now, these are people who basically had either had symptoms of heart disease, so they had some chest pains, they had some chest discomfort, and they were given an angiogram. Angiogram looking at the arteries within the heart. So group number one only received medical therapy. Medical therapy was basically something to reduce clotting in the bloodstream, maybe some aspirin or a drug called Plavix. Mm-hmm. They received statins, drugs such as Lipitor and Zocor. Mm-hmm. Their blood pressure was put under excellent control. They might have also received some nitroglycerin, either in a patch form or a pill form. But these basically, this was intensive medical therapy. Group number two received intensive medical therapy and an angioplasty. Okay, they received both.
Right.
Then they followed them 5 years out, and here's what they found. From a heart attack rate and a death rate point of view, there was no difference between group number one and group number two.
The angioplasty
did not decrease the number of heart attacks, did not reduce the death rate. Now, why is that? Well, there are a couple of theories here. The theories are when you look at a blockage, okay, you've got a blockage, let's say it's a 60 or 70% blockage, and you then think, well, that blockage is more likely to become 100%, right? Because logically, you look at the blockage, yeah, and the angiographers, the cardiologists look at the blockage and say, well, 70% can become 100%. It would make sense to me, just like a stream. And the answer is that blockage is probably not the one that's likely to do it. Mm. It's the more minor things that are occurring within the arterial tree that are much more likely to what we call hemorrhage and develop a clot than the bigger ones. The bigger ones appear to be more stable.
And
those are the ones that are given the angioplasty.
Of course, there are some surgeons who are really, really upset about this.
Well, first of all, there's a whole industry that's been that has evolved around this. You have cardiologists who are trained to do angioplasty. The universities and the medical centers, yeah, are putting them out left and right. We have had a belief system for years that these things are good. There are new stents that are put in that are called drug-eluting stents that appear to be better, but they turn out to cause blood clots. There are a lot of issues here.
There are still occasions when surgery is
absolutely
important.
And there are still occasions when angioplasty are needed, but this is the time, if you're asked or told you need an angioplasty, to say to your doctor or cardiologist, are you sure this is right for me, and get a clinical judgment.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a problem with toe cramps at night. Hmm. I walk 2.5 miles every day, and times when I get to bed, get to sleep, and then my toes go straight up in the air, and I literally have to get out of bed and walk. And when I get back into bed, sometimes that cramp will go right to the back of my thigh, and it gets a great big ball.
Ooh.
And I'm wondering what causes it. How can you eliminate these?
Yeah.
This sounds really painful.
Oh, it is. It's terrible.
Oh.
And there are times you have to actually walk for 5, 6, 7 minutes before it will walk itself out. But when it happens like 4 or 5 times during the night.
And people who have legs that cramp up at night, it's a problem. Let's look at your bed covers. How heavy are your bed covers?
Well, it's a down comforter.
I'll tell you something that actually works for some people who have these leg cramps. What happens is, this is after you're asleep, while you're going to sleep. Give me just a bit more
information. After I'm asleep.
Mm-hmm. What happens is the cover pushes on the great toe and on the foot, and then that eventually can produce a cramp, which is a reflex cramp in the calf muscle and in the foot, and then that wakes you up. And covers, there are two ways to treat this. One way is actually to get, it's a little scaffolding that goes above the bed, and it's, they have them in hospitals, basically, and they allow your feet to move freely, and then your foot doesn't have any pressure on it from a cover at all. And for some people, that actually works really, really well.
Okay.
For other people, it's exactly the opposite. They make a really tight bed, and they take a sheet, and they make it so their feet can hardly move at all, and they get in a position, and then your feet don't change much during the night. They move a little bit. But the other way is to go to the exact opposite extreme and have a tight bed with a tight bed cover.
Well, that'd be so uncomfortable for me.
Well, for me, I like to move my feet at all.
Yeah.
But that is the other way to do it. But the scaffolding is the thing I would try. That's what I would do, because basically you want your feet to move freely underneath it. And sometimes people say, well, I do that, but then my legs are cold during the night. Well, you wear socks or you get an electric blanket. That's seriously that you put on top of the scaffolding so it sort of warms up the area. area underneath. But that's what I would recommend. And you can buy these at medical stores. They sell them, and you know, the bed looks a little funny when you make it because you've got the scaffolding underneath it, but it helps it.
Okay, one thing. Can this be caused from taking a statin?
Well, the statin can produce muscle aches, but the muscle aches, the best way to describe those are like the influenza, when you feel like the flu and muscle aches. This is not what you describe. What you're describing is a cramp that occurs, and it really, what you want to do is allow movement of the leg and the foot,
okay.
And you want to stop pressure on top of the foot. Scaffolding is the way I'd go.
Well, I certainly hope it
Good
works.
Good luck. I don't think quinine, magnesium, calcium, I don't think any supplement's going to do it. I would go to a mechanical way.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the call. Let's get now, Zorba, to our medical myth buster. Around this time of year, when the weather starts turning, some people start worrying about getting into summer shape. For some people who've stopped working out, does the muscle turn to fat?
You know, that's been around for years. Gee, I stopped exercising, my muscle turned to fat.
Yeah.
Here it was, I was 18, I was a soccer player or, you know, football player, and I stopped, and all of a sudden my muscle
turned to fat.
And the answer is, that is a myth.
No.
Muscle does not turn to fat.
Yes, you have muscle, and then after a while, if you don't work out, then you lose the muscle and it turns to fat.
Muscle does not turn to fat. There are two different cells in the body, and muscle does not turn to fat. But here's what actually happens. Okay, you're toned up. You're exercising. You got 3 to 5% body fat, or if you're a woman who's an exerciser and a triathlete, maybe you've got 8 to 9% body fat, and then you stop. You know, and what happens is you continue to eat the same number of calories. So what happens is because you're no longer exercised, these hypertrophied muscles that get bigger because you exercise begin to shrink. The cell doesn't change; it just becomes a little smaller, becomes less puffy. So the muscle is no longer there, and then you keep on eating your calories, and what happens is your fat cells then become bigger, and so what you're looking at is bigger fat cells and smaller muscle cells, and there's a difference in the ratio of the size of the fat to the muscle cells.
It's two separate processes
going on at the same time. Muscle does not turn to fat. What happens is the muscle shrinks because you're not using it, and the fat expands because you're putting on those calories into those fat cells.
Yeah.
So it is a myth that muscle turns to fat.
I shouldn't admit this, but do you ever? I bet you do sometimes too. If you've done a lot of snow shoveling in the winter, and you're starting to kind of feel it. Do you ever stand in front of the mirror and kind of do this and look at
I never do that. I never do that. I haven't done that either. Should I try to do that? I hate snow shoveling. Maybe that's my problem. You stand in front of the mirror.
I do it.
Yeah, and what do you see?
Everybody knows that I'm a skinny guy that has nothing to look at, but my imagination is great.
I'm there, man. I'm there. I'm with it.
Arnold in the good days.
Arnold, there you go.
800-462-7444. 413, our toll-free number. Oh, and if you have a medical myth, we'll try to bust it or prove it right. Just send it along in an email with the subject titled Myth Buster. Make sure to send that email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Another call now, Zorba. This one from Willow Spring, Missouri. Hi.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Fine. How can we help you?
I guess when I was about 17 or so, I started developing this toenail discoloration on my big toe, and it kind of started spreading to my other toe slowly. So I went to the doctor, and all they did was remove my nail, which was kind of painful.
Yeah.
And, you know, it helped for a little while. Then I joined the Marine Corps, went to boot camp, and, you know, a few months later, after boot camp and everything, it kind of just started coming back. And, now it's much worse than before. I actually have it on both big toes and a couple of my smaller toes on one of my feet. So,
yeah. Well, we'll just have to pull them out again.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen again.
I don't think it's going to happen. Not based on what you said, Tom. I don't think that is going to happen. But let's look at this. You have a fungal infection of that great toe, of the big toe, and basically it has now spread to some of the other toes.
Mm-hmm.
Injured it when you were younger?
I was athletic, but there was no significant like trauma or anything.
No specific injury.
But you know, my father has the same thing as does my sister.
Oh, I see. I see. Often fungal infections can be associated with injuries. So if you're a soccer player, you know, you're hitting the ball all the time, that'll do it. Football will do it. And, you know, anything that bangs on your toe will do it. You know, drop something on your toe. If you work on a farm, for instance, and you drop things or you work in manual labor. Treatment for you basically is medication. That's what I would recommend. Not removal of the toenail. It does nothing at all. As you know, it grew back and now it's spreading to the other nails.
Right.
So what you want to do is consider medication, but the medicine can be expensive. I want to talk a little bit about the medicine. There's a couple of drugs. Lamisil is one. Sporanox is another one. They advertise on television. Do you have a medical plan that covers medicine?
No, I don't anymore. I did when I was in the Marine Corps. Well, separated those, so I'm kind of without it now.
Well, you've got a couple of options here. First of all, you know, you can have an option of it's not going to do any harm. You wait until you have a medical plan that covers it. You go into the doctor. They often have to do a scraping to prove that it's a fungus, and then you take the drug for 12 weeks.
Yeah, that may be worth it. I love to wear flip-flops and stuff, but I just won't, you know.
Right. You got to look for it. Sporanox, Lamisil, those are the drugs. And there's another thing called Penlac, PENLAC.
Uh-huh.
And this is basically a fungal nail polish. That's the name brand. There is no generic out there at all. And that also is effective. And you put it on for like 12 to 16 weeks. And what you have to do is you got to kill the fungus under the nail. That's
right.
Why it comes back. Treat it that way. Do not have the nail removed. It's going to spread to others. And like you said, you want to wear flip-flops when the weather is warm, you know.
Right.
And you don't want to have a funny-looking nail because people will look at it.
All right. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Appreciate the call. A quick note before we go, Zorba. Are you ready for the grammar police to come in?
Oh, great. I love the grammar police. Bring it on, baby. Bring it on.
This one comes to us from Deputy Dan.
Deputy Dan.
He writes, the singular of data is datum, and the singular of bacteria is bacteria.
That's right. That's
you know that.
Right.
We must have slipped up on it.
Oh, I just slip all the time. You know, I slip all the time. They are correct. They are correct. On the other hand, we must give the devil its due. There is the correct way to say it, and then there is the normal way that people often say it.
People,
and this is one of the mistakes.
People don't tend to use datum very often, even though it is the
only
accepted.
You know, datum, when you say datum, you will sound like a prig. And if there's anything I don't want to sound like in America, it's a prig. Eat that.
If you catch non-prig Zorba breaking any more grammar laws.
I ain't no prig.
Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next time, Zorba.
A pleasure. Stay well, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web.
At ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.